Do you have a fan or something going?
No. Only thing I can think of you're hearing is car traffic.
Yeah, it's more sustained than that and closer sounding.
Well, yeah, the road's right there. Recording right on the sidewalk. Gosh.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me again, here, finally, not quite in the flesh, is Richard Wally from Portland, Oregon.
And with me not here in my flesh, wait, that sounded perverted, is Cassidy Robinson from the LA area.
Perverted or like I'm like wearing you like a coat, like I'm some like Buffalo Bill guy?
Well, it could be either way, because it could be perverted in that sense, too, if we're going with the older, like, version of the word.
Right.
A perversion of normal society. So it could be either, really.
Wearing skin coats, yes. Last week, you had family over or something to that effect, right?
Yeah, I had family.
And I had my birthday festivities.
Yes, you have to have a week for to do.
Well, here's the thing. My birthday landed on a Wednesday or a Tuesday. It landed on a Tuesday, so I actually requested that day off just to kind of, like, not have to work on my birthday. But I ended up not really doing anything because the weekend was coming up, and I'd already had something planned with my friends, and that kind of ended up ballooning into a lot more than I thought it would be. I thought it would be me, a couple of people, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And it ended up being, like, this, like, theme party of everyone who knows me, you know, with the exception of you and Jackie. We should have Skyped you in.
Well, I'm offended that we weren't invited.
I invited friend of the show Keith Foster and his wife. They ended up coming.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was talking to a friend of ours who lives in Las Vegas, and she ended up coming for the weekend because she, like, wanted to come and look at L.A. because she's thinking of moving here and whatever. And then we had all of my friends from grad school and that I've met down here all at the same time. So it was like a kind of a hullabaloo.
Oh, well, fun.
So on Friday we ended up, or Saturday we ended up watching Jaws on the Beach.
That's fun.
I talked to you about when we went to Indiana Jones on the Beach and had to leave early because we were too cold.
You also told me about your going to Jaws on the Beach. So this is not new news to me, but to the other people, I can pretend it's new news. It's new news.
It's new. It's brand new.
Also, the Facebook tells me everything.
Hot off the presses.
It tells me what you eat. It tells me everything.
That's weird, because I don't post what I eat.
Oh, it tells me everything, Cassidy. Bathroom times, when you get up, when you leave your house.
I don't think you're talking about Facebook. I think you're talking about some weird spy app you've downloaded.
Oh, sorry. You're not wrong.
So yeah, Jaws on the Beach was as cool as expected. We didn't have quite as good of a spot because there was a lot more people there than there was for Indiana Jones.
Well, yeah, that's Jaws on the Beach. That makes fucking sense.
Right.
They should make you go swimming afterwards, too.
That's what I said after it was over to all my friends. I was like, okay, who wants to go for a dip? Because we were literally right there next to it. And luckily, since we'd done so poorly at Indiana Jones at the beach, we were, like, we're prepared this time with blankets and hoodies.
Right.
And that was cool. And then the next day, we went to LACMA to go see the Guillermo del Toro exhibit at the museum.
Hmm. I'm a little jealous of that.
I mean,
the Jaws is pretty cool, too, I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah. I only took one photo. Like, some of my friends were, like, just snapping away throughout the entire museum. I was a little nervous about that because I know it's, like, not really what you're supposed to do at museums. But the one picture I did take is Guillermo del Toro. I don't know if it's a replica or if it's like from the movie. He has the helmet from Phantom of the Paradise.
Oh, I think it's the actual helmet.
Right. And it was next to something movie related as well. But I took a picture of that.
I think you can take pictures in that one just because it's like,
it's his personal artifacts. It's his
artifacts, right? But it's also like, there's been tons of like people coming into his little home with like cameras and stuff like that and stuff. Mm. So, and there's literally a book out, catalogs and categorizes things.
Right. I think
you'd really like it.
I probably would. They had something I thought was cool, and I could have spent like the whole time looking at that. In fact, at one point, my friend who was kind of with me,
mm-hmm.
She was like, "Okay, you need to like stop looking at this. Like other people are behind us." But it was like an ebook version. They went through one of his diaries, you know, the mm-hmm. ones that he like sketches in and does all his thumbnails and writes all of his notes.
Yeah,
they had ebooked an entire one of those on like a bolted down tablet or whatever, and you could like swipe through and read every page.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a lot of time just looking at that.
Oh yeah, they have a book version of that. I've read it.
Oh, like all the way?
I think it's excerpts from a bunch of different ones, but right. It's whatever that one is. I don't remember what it was mm-hmm. called. I read it. It was good.
Yeah,
it was interesting.
It's hard to actually read a lot of the notes because it's in Spanglish.
Oh, I didn't have a problem with that.
It's kind of scribbly. Like, it's not, like, you know, meant to be read by other people.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
this book, it goes through, like, each movie, and then it has some of his notes from his book, and it has other things. But then at the end of the book, it had, like, four movies that he hasn't produced.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was a cool book.
So, yeah, that's my big fat excuse for why we didn't have a show last week and the week before, so.
You had a birthday?
I had a birthday. I leveled up. Let's go ahead and get into our movie news.
Okay.
I'll let you start. What's the first one you have?
So this is ever in the news and always say it's going to happen. The Crow remake.
Mm-hmm.
This time, Jason Momoa is attached with the director, Corin Hardy. Corin Hardy has only really done like one full length feature called The Hollow. It came out this year. It's a horror film. I haven't caught up with it yet. Been wanting to.
Mm-hmm.
So
we might get to it.
We might. Maybe. But anyways, this Crow remake is supposed to start filming this January with Jason Momoa attached as the titular character. So, he's got, I think, a good look, and he does have a weird charisma to him. I've seen him holding a guitar in a picture
mm-hmm.
when he was first like approaching this role. And I was like, actually, I kind of see it. Like with a lot of the other people, I didn't really see it. Like, they've had weird people attached to this. They've had, like, Bradley Cooper and Tom Hiddleston and all sorts of, and, like, lesser-known names like Jack Huston or something like that. And
yeah.
All those guys, I was like, I guess. I mean, they're kind of skinny and they've got dark hair. But this is the first time I was like, no, I for some reason, I can see him playing the character. Now, the music and all that kind of stuff from the original, if you're expecting that, I don't think will be there.
Mm-hmm.
But think about the death metal version of this movie, Cassidy. I know you're very into metal right now, so this is how I'm selling it.
Yeah, I don't see it. I don't have a problem with Jason Momoa in concept, or, you know, as a person anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are things you can do with him. This is not one of them. I don't know if he can carry a movie. By the way, if this movie actually does get made with him, this is essentially his big testing the waters, no pun intended, for Aquaman. Because if this movie fails with him in it, then that could mean problems for DC, which they don't need at this point. I think he's too much of a heavy. He's too big. The whole point of the story, if they're going from the original comic and updating, you know, basically what they already did in 1994 with Brandon.
Have you read the original comic?
Yeah. Okay. I have it.
I haven't, so I was just wondering.
Yeah. I mean, the whole idea there is that he wasn't like this big, buff, you know, bodybuilder looking Polynesian dude.
Mm-hmm.
He was like this, you know, I mean, he has like some muscle tone or whatever. but he was like this kind of normal everyday rocker gothy guy who gets killed by these gang, like regular gangsters. And I think as soon as you turn that character into a heavy, as soon as you turn him into this big buff guy, it kind of like discredits him as in any kind of relatable sense. Cause then it just makes him another, like, it's Schwarzenegger with superpowers.
Sure.
So I don't know about that. And
I'm okay with it, especially as an action film, because I mean, I if we're talking about like the original like movie and some of the source material and stuff like that, which I know a bit about, mm-hmm. like this adaptation, they could really go anywhere, and it can be. And the thing about The Crow is I know that it's an embodiment. It's like a weird revenge thriller kind of thing. So I don't. Right. I mean, anybody could come in that place. I mean, I do think it's going to be Eric Draven.
Right.
He's going to be playing that specific character. So, I mean, in that way, he doesn't look like him. But I'm sorry. I don't give a shit about if the character looks like perfect or anything. So as long as it's done well, mm-hmm. is kind of the key.
Well,
it's hard to talk about that because Colin Hardy, again, he's had one feature and we have neither of us have seen it.
I mean, I just don't think this remake needs to happen, period. But if it's going, I think the best way to go about it is to just do a different character than Eric Draven. Like, you know, even like, cause it's like a, like you said, it's an embodiment. It's like a mythology thing.
Yeah.
Like you could even set it in a different time period, put it in like the medieval times or something like that or like, you know, Viking or something. Then I could believe Jason Momoa as some Viking crow. But I just don't see him as like this, like, you know, rock and roll guy who his girlfriend dies and like, I don't know. There's a certain amount of emotional stuff that has to work for that story to work. Mm-hmm. And I don't see it from Jason Momoa, but maybe I just haven't seen enough of him because I never watched Game of Thrones. And the only stuff I've really seen him in is like playing heavies in, like background action movies.
In Game of Thrones, at least, there's a turn with that character, and he becomes a lot much more sensitive, and he plays a part that he can play weak and I think he can. I think he's got a certain type of charisma to him that, I think could work as a more leading person, kind of almost in a, Chris Hemsworthy kind of way.
All right, moving on. I'm going to do these two stories together, I suppose. The CW is setting up a Lost Boys television series, and the showrunner is Rob Thomas of Veronica Mars and, iZombie and Party Down fame. And, the other story is that, The Departed is being developed as a TV series on Amazon. So, what do you think of that?
Well, specifically, I guess I did like Veronica Mars, and Party Down, really.
Yeah.
We watch iZombie. It's not very good. It's kind of fun, but it's not very good.
Okay.
I don't know. Specifically with The Lost Boys, it's a fun property. It's one of my favorite vampire movies, especially of that kind of
that
time
era.
Period.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause you got like that and Fright Night and, I kind of lump it with Fright Night and Near Dark, even though they're kind of different movies in some respects, but...
No, I get you. Yeah.
They're
teenage rock and roll vampire movies.
Yeah, they're fun.
Yeah.
I like that. I specifically, this is one that I probably watch about annually, is The Lost Boys.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's in some respects, I'm like, that's kind of neat. And I could kind of see them kind of unfolding the mythology in a bigger way.
Yeah, that actually of all the things that TV or movie to TV properties, this one actually makes more sense than others. A, because, yeah, obviously there's like the whole like Vampire Diaries post Twilight thing you could tap into if you wanted to. There's even already a romance kind of set in place.
Don't say that.
I'm just saying.
Now you're depressing me.
I'm just saying, and it's the CW.
It does, you're right, it does. And it is the CW, so everyone will be beautiful.
Which runs...
Everyone.
Which currently does Vampire Diaries.
But well, yeah, they've also had Supernatural, which a lot of people are beautiful in as well, as I said before. And
right.
I mean, they have some of doing semi-horror stuff, too. I think that they do want to get rid of Supernatural, because, I mean, it's like on its 14th season or something ridiculous like that.
Yeah, that needs to end. And actually, the tone of Supernatural would fit pretty well with the tone of Lost Boys. So, I mean, too bad whoever showruns that. I guess that McGee.
He did till five, and then it had a natural arc of a story, and he was like, "That's what I came on to do." And now it's been somebody else for a long time, and I haven't really been paying attention as much. But
right. But anyway, so I think actually, yeah, this story makes a lot of sense. You got a lot of characters, you got a kind of a mythology that's already kind of, like you said, set in a place that you can kind of work on, and expand. So, and they've done like two other.
In a fake California town, so that would make it easy. Also, yeah. I still think, even though it's fake, I always still think that you're from there.
I'm not, like, at all.
I know.
I'm not even from the town it's pretending to be.
I know.
I just hope that they maintain the tone of the show, that they don't try and turn it too Twilight or too modern or too a lot of things. I hope that they, because part of the fun of that movie, The Lost Boys in particular, is that it's kind of campy. And it's it has like, yeah, kind of a rock and roll sort of punky sort of spirit to it. And, it doesn't take itself too seriously, but
as long as they have a saxophone guy.
Yeah.
That's what's important. He should have a whole arc because now it's a TV series. Saxophone guy should have a
greased up saxophone player. And as far as the Departed series goes on Amazon, I haven't watched any Amazon shows. I know like, what's that one with Jeffrey Tambor?
Yeah. Transplanted? No. Is it that on the nose?
It is. It's kind of close to being that on the nose.
I've heard that's good, yeah. Yes. I don't know. I haven't watched very many Amazon specifically produced shows either. I've watched things on Amazon, but not theirs.
Right. I watch some movies on Amazon every once in a while, but I've never watched any of their original shows, so I can't really say as to the quality of that. What was that one about, like, if that, like, alternate universe of Nazis had taken over World War II?
Oh, yeah, I've heard about that one, too, being, like, fun, or having a specific little, like, cult following, I guess you could almost say.
Yeah, I had a little bit of early buzz, and then I haven't really heard much about it since. It's kind of interesting, because The Departed is already a remake of a Chinese film.
Right.
Infernal Affairs. A fairly successful adaptation, I think. I think, actually, The Departed is one of those rare cases where the American remake is better.
Probably, yeah. Have you seen the original, then?
Yeah, I've seen Infernal Affairs.
Okay, cool.
And it's cool. It's a good movie, and it has the same kind of, like, dynamics that make that story work. I just think that when Scorsese did it, he kind of took what was essentially like a post-John Woo sort of action thriller, and gave it a little bit more context. He kind of filled out the characters a little bit more. He kind of made the world more specific, and it was less just a genre piece and more kind of a little bit more character-driven.
Right.
No,
it makes sense what you're saying. Departed was really well, the execution of it and having those intertwining stories. Now, right. I would say that the one thing about that adaptation that a TV can do, because we are talking about that, it can go more in depth. So you can get those intertwined in those different parts, disparaging parts. You can make that even tighter. So I can see a life for it on TV, but it really depends on the showrunners. And I know so little about them that I don't trust it as much.
Also, I mean, I'm assuming, like, the tension of the show is going to be the same as the movie, which is you have a mole from the police infiltrating the gangs and a mole from the gangs infiltrating the police. And when are the two paths going to cross? That's sort of the tension of the movies. We already kind of know how that ends.
They can change that for TV. And I mean, honestly, right. You know, my one, I guess, the reason I make a big caveat is we just recently watched Fargo on TV. And, I mean, the other thing, too, is that's an FX show. And so that to me usually gives us more credence. AMC, HBO, FX. Those are channels that I go, oh, okay, they're going to try to do something. Amazon is an unknown property to me, so I can't say as much. But I know that they can take a show premise, expand it, and even though if they're borrowing some looks and they're doing some different things, they can make it its own, like, wonderful thing.
Right.
Fargo was very good. It had great performances. it was still funny and dark at the same time. It did that same thing, and it also kind of pulled apart that, you know, the American ideas and dreams and stuff like that. And it did the same thing that the movie did, just in a show, and it works. So I can see The Departed working in TV because of an example like Fargo, but it takes a good showrunner. So, I mean, it's no different than film with the director. If you don't have that person in the lead who knows how to make a charge and knows how to make a good product, then it doesn't matter. And so that's where the caveat of this falls.
Right.
Is who is the showrunner? What are they going to do with it? And I mean, you said you had known the writer a little bit.
No.
Oh.
No, not even a little.
Oh, this is the one you said to me and you thought that I might know and I didn't have any clue.
Right. You're like, Jason Richman is writing the series. He did something called Detroit 187. I don't know if that's a movie or television show. So that's all we really have to go on. That, and I guess the success of recent Amazon shows.
Well, I think that they are trying. I mean, I feel like from what I've noticed of their stuff and stuff like that, they do want to compete with Netflix in like a meaningful way. And so they might put the money behind it to try to make something decent. But I just don't know. Like, a lot of times they do look like the lower rent version of a Netflix thing. So,
yeah. The show is Transparent.
Transparent.
That's what it's called. Yeah.
I knew it was something trans something.
All right, what's your last story?
That Johnny Depp guy, he's not going to be putting on 10 pounds of prosthetics and a wig and period piece clothing or anything like that. He's going to be playing a detective that's going to be investigating the assassinations of Tupac Shakur and Biggie Smalls in his next role. It's in a film called The Labyrinth. I guess it's based on a book. And I'm always excited when he moves away from this stuff, but the last time I saw a movie with Johnny Depp where he played somebody real, he still had prosthetics on. I referred to him as Irish Dracula. He played Whitey Bulger talking about The Departed as well. Holy cow.
Yeah.
I thought that was a terrible film, and everybody kept telling me, no, it's all right. And I was like, no, this is not a good film. I see a different film than everybody else. But, I don't know. If he plays like a semi-nuanced human being.
Right.
Which he's just playing like a kind of detective, it seems like. Mm-hmm. And this is based on a real book about a real detective. So, we'll see. It, to me right now, I'm feeling parallels of Black Mass.
Right.
I'm going to give it the benefit of the doubt because I know he can play a nuanced character. I've seen him do it before and it would be good to see. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't have a problem with this in theory and it sounds fine. It's kind of goofy sounding to me. Like this detective is trying to get down to the bottom of these really high profile murders, which by the way, have never really been solved.
Right.
And so I don't know what story wise how they're gonna conclude that. But also it's so pop culture driven that I wonder. My thing is like, okay, what are you doing here? Like, what are you guys doing?
Oh, you're talking to. I was like, I'm sorry. You said that with such a commanding voice that I almost responded as me, not that you were talking to them. I was like, oh, I was reaching for my water. I'm sorry, sir.
No, that's how I feel about the project. Is okay. What's your plan? Like, you know, like I don't know. It seems like it could get goofy. Like what's that show? I mean, actually, people sort of like it, but that one of the OJ show that just happened.
Oh, like American Crime or something?
Yeah, People versus OJ or something like that. Which actually, a lot of people have said is really good. So maybe it's a terrible example, but there's something about that too, where I was just like, this looks a little bit like dress up.
Well, Straight Outta Compton just came out, you know. The one thing about that, though, that I can see is kind of zeitgeisty, but it is a time and a place in music that actually has really influenced our world and really has some kind of relevance. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I go back and forth with it because, again, I feel the same way. I'm like, this could be kind of goofy. And also, is he going to wear prosthetics?
What if he was the exact same character as he was in Tusk? And he played it that way.
Well, then you know I would hate it.
I'm fine with the idea of this movie. I'll let it happen. Which I guess they can send me a thank you card for that. For letting them make their movie. I want to see a trailer. I want to know what they're up to. I want to know what the angle is. I want to know, like, how involved in the hip-hop thing are they going to let it be? Is it really just going to be kind of like a detective sort of noir investigation kind of thing? Is it going to be more of kind of like, I don't see, that's the thing. It's like, I just have no idea, like, what the angle is.
Well, he's been cast as Russell Poole, who is a real L.A. detective.
Right.
Poole believed that Suge Knight, you know who Suge Knight is, everybody knows the evil Suge Knight, as in many of his betrayals.
Right.
Or trails, not betrayals. Well, maybe you could say both.
The record executive of Death Row Records, who was in jail for a long time. Yeah.
He's pretty shady. We can at least assume that.
Yeah, shady dude.
Yeah, so he's going to play this doctor who believes that Suge Knight hired a police officer to kill Biggie, Biggie Smalls in connection with Shakur's murder. It's based on a book called Labyrinth, and it's like half and half. I think that, you know, because it's this realistic book and it has this kind of documentary behind it and it has these different things, I can see it being a very down to earth portrayal.
Could be cool.
It could be, but then it could be Black Mask. Black Mask looked really cool on the onset. It could be this, you know, Irish Dracula type. And I just was like, okay, let's tone down the mood here. This is one of the things that I...
Well, we've already said for a long time that Johnny Depp is one of those actors, especially lately, who's as good as his director. And he needs, because he's such a big star and people are so happy to have him in his movie, he needs to be one of those guys who a director needs to know when to tell him no.
He needs a wrangler.
He needs someone to give him a lot of direction. Which isn't to say that he's a bad actor, but he just tries things. And sometimes just trying things has been worked out very well for him in the case of a lot of the Tim Burton stuff and in the case of Jack Sparrow. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of movies where he can't just go off the rails like that. He needs somebody who has an overall vision of the film and what the tone and what the look and everything's supposed to be, and he needs to fit into that. You know, and hopefully we'll have something kind of more along the lines of like a Donnie Brasco or a Blow era Johnny Depp, because we haven't seen that in a while.
Exactly, and we know he's capable, so.
Yeah.
Moving on.
Let's get into our first review here. We saw a couple movies while we were doing things. And one of them, which I've actually seen more recently, is Kubo and the Two Strings, an animated film from Laika Studios over in your stomping grounds in Portland, Oregon.
That is correct. It's right downtown by my wife's work. It's in the Pearl District.
So. Oh, I wonder if they let you tour or take pictures. Probably not.
I haven't heard anything. I don't think so. I think they're smallish. Mm-hmm. No, they're not. They're not. They're kind of big, but they're kind of small. It's kind of weird. Anyway, go on.
Right. In the grand scheme of animated studios, they're fairly small. But, you know, Laika is pretty well known for working almost primarily in stop animation, with a little bit of CGI embellishment. But, you know, they put out Coraline from Henry Selick, as well as Paranorman. A few years ago, they put out Box Trolls. So they have a brand, and it's kind of based upon that sort of Selick-y looking, Tim Burton-y sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I think, the furthest they've sort of stepped away from that.
Agreed.
And I think that with this film, they're really kind of pushing the boundaries of what they do visually, what they do stylistically, and really kind of almost seeing if they can exist outside of that sort of angsty 14-year-old Hot Topic customer kind of appeal.
Hey, buddy.
And I say that not necessarily as a bad thing, because I love Coraline.
And I really liked
Paranorman quite a bit. So this one is a story. It takes place in sort of like Edo era Japan, I suppose. And it's about a young, one-eyed storyteller, guitar player kid named Kubo, who's being raised by a single mother out in the wilderness, who she kind of tells him these stories, and he goes back into town and sort of recalls these stories. He has the abilities to be able to play the guitar, which then creates origami like puppet shows for the people. And he has to kind of tell the stories in pieces because he's waiting for his mother, who has memory loss problems, to kind of give him the rest of the story. Eventually, this story that she's telling sort of enwraps what's going on in the movie and his life. And he finds out that he's much more connected to it than he was. And these evil entities, these sisters of his mother, who she was running from when Kubo was just a child, find them and wants to claim Kubo for their own. And the mother sort of disappears and leaves him with a couple of protectors to go along his journey while he's trying to find this sacred armor that he's supposed to use to defeat the evil Moon King and these sisters. We have a monkey who's voiced by Charlize Theron. And we have a beetle samurai. And who does his voice?
Matthew McConaughey.
Oh, yeah. Which I didn't, for whatever reason, I didn't recognize. The whole time I was trying to place it.
Oh, and really?
I mean.
Oh, okay.
Had I known.
I thought it was very, very obvious, but go on.
Well, he didn't say, all right. So that might have helped.
He got close a few times. I was like, he tried. And they were like, wait, no, don't do that.
You can't do your signature move here. Rooney Mara does voices of the sisters. And Art Parkinson, what, don't know who he is. He did the voice of Kubo. And like I said, going into the movie, I was really kind of, I was interested to see what they would do in this kind of setting, which is not like their typical thing. And it really is, I think by far their most visually ambitious film they've ever done.
Sure.
It's a lot more quiet. It's a lot more breathy than their other movies. It's a little artier, I would say, than a lot of their movies. It deals a lot more in kind of symbolism. It has that whole kind of Eastern sort of Buddhist subtext to the whole thing anyway. So that sort of blends to that. A lot of it reminded me of Life of Pi. And then it also has these really elaborate action set pieces. There's this one in particular where Charlize Theron's monkey character is fighting these sisters who are like throwing these like chains at him. Like it works just as well as anything out of like Crouching Tiger or any of those old like Wire Fu movies. And it really has a lot of visual action movie panache to it when it wants to. And then also, you know, you have this kind of journey with these kind of interesting idiosyncratic characters that feels a lot like kind of like a, I guess, Wizard of Oz sort of style odyssey. And I liked it a lot up to a point. I think the movie could have stuck its landing a little better. It doesn't have a bad ending, but it has a little kind of a clumsy ending, in my opinion. And some of the emotional stuff of the parental aspect of it, I guess we'll say, I thought really was working for a lot of the movie until they decide to do weird things with that. And I know I'm being cryptic, but I kind of have to be. But I like the movie. I didn't love it as much as I thought I was going to from the first two thirds, but I think it's definitely worth seeing, and definitely worth seeing in theaters.
Yeah, I agree with most of everything you said. I know specifically they are trying to kind of do like, I know that they took from influences for tone and pacing. They took more from like Miyazaki and, Kurosawa. People that they were specifically looking at. I think that this was still a very strong and very, very beautiful to watch film. And I do think that it is cinematic beyond what most animated movies are.
Mm-hmm.
They do have action like set pieces, which you were kind of talking about. And I think that the kind of intermingling of the magic and everything, I actually think I'm a little bit more positive, and you're fairly positive on this. So for me, this was a beautiful, the ending, I can agree that they didn't really necessarily, the emotional ties of some of the family stuff didn't exactly work out because you didn't necessarily have the development of some of the, sisters and, and so, some of the other characters.
Right, the Moon King and this kind
your
of
other,
stuff.
Yeah, your other antagonists. And so I think that was actually part of it, because you didn't get the full family dynamic.
Right.
But I do still think that this was a beautiful film, and I just still do kind of think it has some resonance, and it is still a decent film. And I think with kids especially, I don't... And this is one that kids and parents can watch in tandem together. And I think that besides Pixar, these are the only guys that are really delivering at this level. I think that they are some of the only people in competition with Pixar.
Agreed.
And I do like their products in general. I mean, I know you weren't as crazy about Box Trolls, but I thought that that had... But I think that there's a weird emotional resonance in all of their films. And maybe I'm just a sap for liking them, but I think that this one was also very good. Also, I just like that it's quirky and it's made, you know, they take an older style and they mix it with CG and they do this kind of hybrid of the two. And it just has a quirky style to it that you're not getting anywhere else. All the other companies that are trying to ape Pixar, they're doing their own thing, and they really do have their own brand. So,
right, and they don't make as many films as Pixar gets to do, or any of the other companies, Illumination or DreamWorks or whatever, who are making these CG movies, kind of pumping them out two or three a year. Because they're working in stop animation, their projects go much slower and stay in gestation for much longer, and it's painstaking to make these films. So they. You feel that kind of love and work put into it. And I think that stop animation, or go motion or whatever however you want to call it, has a tactility to it that you lose in purely CGI, computer animation.
Agreed. There's these weird, they'll do these weird, really in close shots of the mouths.
Mm-hmm.
And they have this strange, cool, like tactile sense to them that you just don't get anywhere else. You don't even get in 2D animation. Let's be honest.
Mm-hmm.
So I find the film just endearing at an aesthetic level too. And maybe that's, I don't think it's just pure nostalgia because we watched all of, I mean, this is technically kind of the bones of that same company that made all those claymations, those like animated ones from when we were kids.
Right.
But I think it has its own thing. And Kubo, I think, is in line with those. And I think is a great product still. And I think that I really thought the pacing was quite great. And I do think that the first two thirds are a little stronger. I actually, what's weird is, I know that you don't really necessarily want to make a kid's movie longer, but I almost feel like this one warranted to be a little longer.
Oh, that's interesting. I thought it was about the right length. My issue with it primarily was it wraps up a little too neatly. And I get it. I get that it's a kid's movie and it can't be so obscure, like, because it flirts with kind of being an art film, but it can't fully tip into that because it still needs to be a commercial product at the end.
Sure.
So I think there's some stuff where, you know, they essentially come out and say, well, this means this and this means this, just so you're not confused. And Life of Pi did that too and annoyed me then as well. And I could have just like, I would have liked it more if they had just sort of relied on the symbolism and be like, because when they revealed things that were revealed, I was like, yeah, I got that. You didn't have to come out and say it out loud. Like, I understand who represents who here. And I think it would have been a stronger film if they had just not done that.
But, well, and Miyazaki wouldn't do that either. He would just, I mean, but Miyazaki's films are very...
They're not necessarily made for just kids. I think, what was the Wind Rises? I don't think that was a kid's movie.
No, that one wasn't at all.
Yeah.
That one was definitely made for adults.
Grave of the Fireflies is not a kid's movie.
Well, Princess Mononoke isn't either.
No, yeah, that one's like super violent. So yeah. I mean, the way that, you know, animation is dealt with in different countries, you know, they don't necessarily see things as... Animation is just a kid's venture. And when they make a movie for adults, it doesn't have to be Sausage Party. Like, it can just be a mature film. And this one, you know, is. I wonder how well it plays for kids, though, because I think that it is pretty breathy. And there is a lot of scenes where people aren't fighting or making jokes or whatever. There are these moments where it kind of soaks in the vistas. And I wonder how well that plays for an audience under 10 years old. I wonder how bored they'd be.
I don't know, because again, I was one of those weird kids that was more into Don the Bluth stuff than I was into the Disney stuff when I was a kid. And the Bluth stuff, they got darker. They also, Secret of Nim has some very slow moving parts.
Right.
And so I think it could still play. I just think that they're, you know, it might be just kids who are like, oh, this is different. Again, the difference is not a bad thing. I'm not saying it as like some kind of pejorative. I'm saying it as the quirky and the being something right. that's playing against what's very popular now is great about this stuff.
Right. And if you look at Laika's work, Coraline, Paranorman, Box Trolls even, and this movie, the through line is these child protagonists who are outsiders.
Yeah.
And who don't fit into their societies and who are looking for their own way.
Right.
And so I think that they're Laika specifically kind of gearing their material towards those kids, not the grand masses.
Yeah, this is the Bluth of this generation. So yeah, no, I don't think the pacing does... I think the pacing is fine. I think to have a non... You know, I like a lot of Pixar's products, but to have a non-Pixar, like, kind of flow, or especially like a DreamWorks where it's like... they're definitely making it just for kids.
Right.
Kind of product, I think is great. So, no, I kind of don't think so. I mean, yeah, I'm sure there are some kids that are like, this is dumb. There's right. no this and this and this. But I'm sure that there are some kids that are like, oh, this is neat. Look at this. And in the intricacies of the puppetry and stuff like that, find something kind of different. Because, again, there is that weird tactile sense to it. Mm-hmm. So I personally lean towards it being fine.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I don't think that the pacing is a problem. I just wonder how a specifically American child audience takes to it. But yeah, no, I liked it a lot. Why don't you go ahead and describe to us what happens in Don't Breathe?
You have this kind of thriller horror setup. Basically, these kids who live in an impoverished area of Detroit, they look for different scores where they can get money so that they can sell it, and so that they can have money so that they can either just live, or you find out that the lead girl, played by Jane Levy, whose character name is Rocky, you find out that she's trying to get enough money to get her and her little sister out of Detroit and in somewhere a little bit more friendly. And apparently surfing in California is the goal.
Right.
It's very expensive, so she needs to steal a lot of stuff. but basically they end up finding the score where it's this blind man who had this settlement from these rich people. He has all of this money locked away in his house in this very beat up, dilapidated neighborhood. And so they go in, and he's not as weak as they find out. And it kind of plays out in this kind of thriller. Is he going almost in a slasher kind of style, but a little bit more fine tuned than just some dude stabbing people? And it gets increasingly weirder, increasingly weirder.
Right. I mean, it's essentially it's a reverse home invasion thriller.
It is a reverse home invasion thriller. That's very good. I Stephen Lang plays the blind man. Never given a name. that they're robbing. I think this is interesting. I think that this is, I had a lot of fun with this. This is a great, like, popcorn horror thriller kind of experience. It didn't blow me away. This is kind of, I would say, almost like Conjuring level. Made very well. Very edited very well. Has some strange twists and turns to it. I did enjoy that part of it. I did again, but it didn't blow me away. Something I did find interesting about it, though, is the Detroit setting. This has been popping up a lot in like more in different horror films, and it follows. I would also kind of include Only Lovers Left Alive and some of these ones.
Sure, but yeah.
I almost feel like right now with the good horror products that are coming out, we're not looking anymore. If you're talking about the 70s and the decline of the American dream and that kind of being absorbed. I feel like now we're looking at American decay. Right. All of the characters in this are thieves, morally kind of backwards, but you kind of have to look at their situations And nobody in this film is really actually really that great. And in all of these films, you see this decay is something that I find that's very interesting. And so this film really, really plays into that. I think at a subconscious kind of like level, you could read this film as kind of like the youth battling an older generation that doesn't kind of know what's going on. And I think you could also look at it as kind of he's an old military guy. He's, you know, there's a lot of kind of things that are in play in this. But I think it's mostly, I don't think that that's on purpose. I go halfway on that because this is Fede Alvarez. Fede Alvarez is the guy that did Evil Dead.
The remake.
Yeah, excuse me. But this, he did the Evil Dead remake, and it did have some weird subtext stuff going on with the drugs and with the drug addiction and stuff in that film. And he has a similar thing with Jane Levy in this, and it's interesting. So I think that there might be something there, but I don't think it plays. I don't think it's as up front and center and purposeful, or at least it doesn't get played out as strongly as Evil Dead. However, unlike Evil Dead, I feel like this is a tighter film in its editing and its story process and everything like that. So, and the other thing is it's original property. Original property did its own thing, very strong.
And did well.
And it did well.
Won two weekends in a row.
I know, it dethroned the diminishing returns of Suicide Squad.
Right.
So, I thought that this was a lot of fun. It did exactly what I wanted it to. It gave me kind of a popcorn kind of thriller experience, and I enjoyed it.
I did too. I enjoyed this movie quite a bit, and I think one of the fun things about this movie is I knew nothing about it. I knew it was called Don't Breathe, and I knew the poster. I didn't know what the premise was. I didn't know anything. When I went in, because I don't have TV, I don't watch trailers online or that kind of thing, and I hadn't seen a trailer for it at the movies. So when I went in, I literally, everything was kind of, you know, I just was able to take in the beats of the story as they came. And I enjoyed it quite a bit. I think this is a fun ride, in a way. And I think that there's a lot of great, sometimes subtle, sometimes not even that subtle, but very, very skilled filmmaking that goes into this to make kind of, to make this sort of work. And I think one of the things that you need for a very, contained location like this, because basically the chunk of the film takes place in this dude's house.
Right.
This kind of dilapidated home in the middle of Detroit. I think what makes it work is that Fede Alvarez does a really good job with his, like, kind of wandering camera technique while we're in the house to give the audience a sense of what the architecture is here and where each room is in context to the other room. And we have a good sense of what this house is. And it kind of becomes a character in the film.
And the dangers that lie within the house, too.
Right. You know, where's the dog? And where's that door that they're trying to get to? If that's locked, then how are they going to get to the back? Like, you have to, for this story to work like it, as well as it does, the audience has to know, as well as the characters know, what the architecture of this setting is. And we do. And I think that a lot of that comes through because of really, really good visual storytelling and visual direction.
Agreed.
And so I think that, you know, Fede Alvarez, it might not even be something that people are really talking about because it's done skillfully enough that it doesn't bring a lot of attention to itself. But I think that is one of the strongest things about the movie. On top of it, it's just a great sort of, funhouse, you know, or spook house kind of a thrill ride experience. And it's believable enough where I had some issues with some of the stuff that happened in Green Room, which I'd say both movies are kind of dealing in similar territory. I think this movie does a really good job of, like, giving me a sense of, like, well, if they do that, they definitely can't do that. And if they go down here, then I know that they can't do this. Like, I have a better sense of the board game rules of the movie than I did with Green Room. And the acting, I think, is maybe not the strongest thing in the movie. I think Stephen Lang does a really good job, but he's kind of a veteran character actor. Jane Levy.
I thought Jane Levy does good.
she's good, and she's the one who has to do the best. Dylan Minnette, he's there. he's been in a few things. I think he was in the Goosebumps movie. He's gonna start being in bigger things here coming up, I've noticed. And he does a good job of playing kind of a sad sack sort of, you know, beta male, friend zone character. The guy, their other friend, this sort of gangster wannabe guy named Money, he has like, cornrows and stuff. I think he was written a little too broadly. I think that character could have been a little more nuanced, a little more interesting, not just immediately, as soon as he's introduced, go, can't wait for him to die.
I halfway agree with you, halfway don't, because I don't know. I kind of like the broad characters, because one thing that I don't like about right now in film is that usually we get a more nuanced character, and sometimes they're so bland that you just don't give a shit at all.
Well, that's how I feel about Dylan Minnette. He's almost sort of that for me. But I think he ends up working out. The other guy, I just thought he was from a different movie, unfortunately. I didn't think that he ruined it, because his purpose serves in the movie. But from that point on, really, once we get past the first act where they're just introducing everything and all the characters and what their deal is, once we get into the meat of it, which is this extended set piece, that's when it all works really well, and I think works on all cylinders, and I think is one of the best examples of one of these kind of horror films that we've seen in a really long time. And I think it's a good popcorn-chewing kind of thrill-ride seat-squirmer.
Yeah. Again, I will say in your whole thing, and I don't want to get into this because we sometimes get a little ridiculous about these things, but finding the navel, as I like to call it, I think I prefer Green Room. It's just a little grittier and a little meaner than this. And it's a little less, I found this film pretty predictable. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's very well made, and that's why I compared it kind of to The Conjuring.
Yeah, certainly not in subject matter.
Not in subject matter. Well, I don't know. You could almost say that Stephen Lang is kind of a ghost haunting this place. In a lot of ways, it's a ghost story, too.
A living ghost.
Yeah. I mean, well, kind of, yeah.
Actually, I mean, one of the fun things about this movie and a lot of this kind of neo-horror stuff is to look back at the references it's obviously pulling. There's direct visual references to Cujo. There's direct visual references to Silence of the Lambs. It's basically, the story is very similar to that Audrey Hepburn, Alan Alda thriller from, or Alan Arkin thriller from the 60s, Wait Until Dark.
Okay.
Did you ever see that?
I haven't.
In that one, Audrey Hepburn is blind and Alan Arkin is trying to rob her and she has to defend herself.
Maybe I have, because that sounds very familiar, but it's been...
It's worth taking a look at again, especially after this movie come out.
Sure.
But, I mean, that reference is fairly obvious, but also then I've heard people talk about The People Under the Stairs, so... There's homage being played all over the movie, but it doesn't feel like a pastiche or a patchwork of other people's ideas. It really kind of gels together into its own sort of thrill ride. And I would say it's primarily a thrill ride. I don't get a lot of like the subtextual stuff that you were talking about. I think it's there if you want it to be, but I don't think that's the driving force.
I think it is earlier, and then once you get into the house, it's gone.
Right.
I don't think that's bad. I just think I think that this is a little tighter project than Evil Dead. I enjoyed the Evil Dead remake. Mm-hmm. But it still, there were times where I was like, this kind of doesn't work here. It kind of is kind of clunky here. I really necessarily care about some of the characters. And in this, you know, I was a little bit more kind of like, ooh, what's going to happen? I can't say that it ever really, even though I would say, even like with The Conjuring, I got a little bit more like boo scared and stuff like that. I didn't really get that here. I didn't really get like on the edge of my seat like I did with like something like Sicario. Sicario last year, like I was like just like riveted and looking and just like, oh gosh, oh gosh, what's going to happen here? And I didn't feel that here. Here I was just like, oh, this is a fun popcorn flick. It's very tightly made. I do think with the visuals, you're right. I did one of the good storytelling things I really saw that I was like, man, that was neat, is that like he'll set you up and show you the gun, as you'd say, kind of in those terms.
Right. In a screenwriting sense.
Yeah. but in this case it was the dog. But then later you kind of like, you're going through and you're doing all this stuff and you're like, ah, and then the dog comes back up and you're like, oh my gosh, I forgot.
Right. I mean, that's a great kind of Hitchcockian move where he introduces us to this idea early on, and throughout the whole movie, you're waiting for that to happen. You know that dog is still out there. That's eventually going to come into play. And it's a great, like,
I forgot with the characters though. And so I think that that's even better done than just being like, oh, it's going to come up. When's it going to come up? Mm-hmm. Like, when it popped up, I was like, oh yeah, shit, the dog. And the character was like that too. So you're right there with them. So I think that if we're talking like pacing and kind of like putting it into the script, I think that is very well executed in that sense.
See, and I thought that, you know, it is, I would say essentially a pop horror film, but I would say that it has enough kind of extreme horror inflections.
Yeah.
It keeps it from just being, you know, a teenage kind of thing. I get, like, it's not just in one of those, like, Scream ripoffs that came out in the late 90s. I think that it has enough grit and it has enough meanness to it that it goes there. And there's a few sequences in particular that really go there.
No, that's what I was going to say. It almost has like a Korean horror vibe, but I he's doing a very good job playing in the genre and doing his own thing and not making a pastiche and all those kind of things. But I do think it is within the horror milieu, and it is something that, you know, people who are horror fans now, they have access to all this stuff.
Right.
Like I wouldn't necessarily say you're a horror fan just because you went to a couple Scream ripoffs. That just means you went to like the popular film that was out that week.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, this is like a horror film for like, I think, not just like those type of teenage kids, but I think for actually people who like kind of the horror thriller aspect, because I wouldn't say this is a pure horror ride either. I would say this has some thriller elements to it.
Sure.
Those ending turns, that's when I actually started really going like, oh, that's interesting. I really liked that. When they really kind of put the screw to the, I don't want to, we obviously are beating around the bush for purposefully, but right, just want to point that out. We're not just being obtuse for no particular reason. Specifically those scenes, I was more like, oh yeah, that's like weird Korean horror territory right now.
Yeah. It that's what I mean. It kind of goes there. Like it's familiar enough to kind of give you the thrill of its genre stuff. But then I think it knows when to ratchet it up and when to do its own thing and when to not just refer to a genre, but to bring something new to the table. And so I really enjoyed this movie. I mean, it's just a testament to what kind of year it's been, but you know, this is one of the better movies I've seen in a while. I definitely recommend Don't Breathe. I think this is another one that's worth seeing in the theater. It's an old style kind of, you know, go with a date and, you know, get grossed out together. It's fun.
Agreed.
Let's go ahead and get into our Netflix homework.
This is the one we'll argue on.
You think so?
No, I don't think so.
I don't know. Fast and the Furious, Tokyo Drift, 2006. I guess we sort of decided to do this as a lark originally.
I don't know. It wasn't. I partially mentioned it because you liked Justin Lin.
Mm-hmm. I like him as an action director, yeah.
And I guess I was also curious because this was, okay, so the first two Fast and the Furious films weren't really looked upon highly. And you know what? As a kid, as a shitty teenager, I watched them ironically. I didn't think they were a fun, I thought they were dumb. Mm-hmm. They were bad acting and kind of silly.
Yeah.
And in between, there was like a few films in between the resurrection of these.
Right, and this is one of them.
Yeah.
This is the first one that Justin Lin directed. The first one was directed by Rob Cohen, who's pretty much bad at everything. And the second one was a huge misfire and a career-ruining thing for John Singleton. And this one, I think this was kind of like a, let's see if we can get anything out of this franchise now. Let's see if we can just sell it on name alone, because for the most part, this had nothing to do with the other two movies. It's a different set of characters, a different setting, a different story, for the most part. I mean, similar in the sense that it's about people racing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think Justin Lin brought a lot of different kind of energy to it as far as his direction style. It still basically has that kind of, like, Mountain Dew ad hyperness to it.
Sure.
That was... And I noticed, like, watching this movie, there's, like, things that are very 2006 about it. Mm. Like, the music choices and sort of just America's fascination with Japan at the time. I think there was a kind of a Japanophile thing going on, like the popularization of anime and sort of like...
It's always happened. I think it's still happening. It's, but yes, it was very prominent at that point.
At that point in particular, I think it was really kind of becoming mainstream at a peak. And I think this movie tried to tap into that a little bit. So the story, Lucas Black plays a troubled teenager, a very unconvincing teenager. Yeah. Because he's clearly like...
Almost, who's this 40-year-old?
Yeah, he's clearly almost 30 years old by the time he was in this movie. But he's supposed to play this troubled teenager who's, you know, been moved around by his mother a lot. He has a military dad living in Japan. And he keeps getting into trouble and he keeps, like, racing people and, you know, destroying public property and that kind of stuff. So after, like, you know, destroying a house that's being built in the middle of a race and totaling his car, he gets sent to Japan to live with his father. And at which point he starts to meet a bunch of new people down there who are doing their drag racing thing in Tokyo, which is different than he's seen in America. His best friend is...
Well, one of them was a little... he was a rapper at one point.
Was it Lil Bow Wow?
It was Lil Bow Wow, yeah, I'm pretty sure.
I thought it was, but it looked like him, but I can't say for certain, and I don't want to be
wrong. I think it was Lil Bow Wow when he was on his change to becoming Big Bow Wow.
To just Bow Wow. His name in the movie is Twinkie. He's one of the only other Americans who lives in Japan with him. And together they meet this kind of Yakuza wannabe gangster teenager kid who does a lot of eyebrow and bangs acting. If you notice that.
It kind of worked though.
Yeah, you know, he has this thing. I guess the deal here, it's the whole idea of drifting, which is essentially this fetishization of peeling out.
Of being able to, like, go completely sideways with your car, right?
Yeah, and be able to race and, like, then do, you know, very quick turns and that kind of stuff. And it's a style that our Lucas Black character is not familiar with, so he kind of takes on a sensei of sorts, who sort of teaches him the ways of the drift.
It is kind of a kung fu film in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, story-wise, it reminded me a lot of, like, Karate Kid. Very much so. And I think those beats are kind of played to on purpose.
Sure.
They even mention, I think, Karate Kid at one point or make a reference to it. So I'm going to say it was probably quite on purpose. But it works in that way. I think, it's cheesy in all the ways you know it's going to be. And Lucas Black is just like... I've never been into that kid. He was in Legion. He was in that movie Get Low, which is actually like a legitimate film. And I guess he was in Jarhead, and he's been in some bigger films. He has like one of the most debilitating Southern accents of all of film history that he has never even bothered to shake off. But he kind of fits in this world okay because he's supposed to be a fish out of water.
Yeah.
And you don't really need a lot from him as a protagonist. And you know what? I had fun with the movie.
Well, I think that's one thing that you can kind of know is like I still to this day think that most of these films aren't that great. I think that they're kind of silly. I don't understand the mass zeitgeist obsession with them. The fifth film, I think, is the best one, also done by Justin Lin. And also, I did really like Star Trek Beyond. Mm-hmm. And you can see kind of like he's good at storytelling, connecting A to B to C, you know, in that kind of sequence. And I honestly, he does kind of have a popcorn quality, but that's not, I don't mean that again in a pejorative way. I think he does it really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
He does that thing really well, and he hits beats very well. Yes, this movie, the soundtrack could just have been Kid Rock music the whole time. And it is a little silly, but even with the bangs acting and everything you've mentioned, it still has kind of a weird charming quality to it. I would not have approached it on my own. Neither will I ever rewatch it, but I can kind of see why people, like, even were kind of a little bit more into this one than maybe some of the other films that came out before it.
Right, because this movie in particular has its own cult.
Yeah.
Like, outside of just the general fan base of the Fast and the Furious movies, Tokyo Drift, especially before the big reboot after Fast 5.
Yeah.
The second wind that the franchise took. There was kind of like a Tokyo Drift is where it's at kind of following.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always sort of curious about that. It was one of the reasons I wanted to watch it. It's like, well, what is it about this movie? And I see that it appeals in all the ways that, like, the first two movies were trying to. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, I think is better directed, especially on an action level.
Agreed.
But, I mean, I think I could see, like, why a big number of people just didn't see it, because it has none of the original actors and it really is just its own thing. I mean, I think last time we did an episode, I called it the season of the witch of the series.
Sure.
But later, Sung Kang, who plays the Lucas Black's, like, sensei or whatever, he ended up coming back as playing the same character in Fast 5, which I guess canonically takes place before Tokyo Drift, which kind of doesn't make sense.
I think he was in 5 and 6. Mm-hmm. And I looked into the mythology, because that is something that actually kind of caught my eye. I was like, okay, how does this work? Mm-hmm. And so I ended up starting to kind of get into it, and I was like, okay. So it happens between the movies 6 and 7, and mm-hmm. then you were supposed to get more, I guess, from the Lucas Black character, because he is in 7. I didn't remember that.
Neither did I.
Looked it up.
I don't think he was a big character in it, though. I think he maybe shows up. I think he's supposed to be in the next one, too.
I think it was a smaller thing, but it's kind of weird to think about. Mm-hmm. When you've watched these films and you go back to this and it's like, oh, it takes place during this one. So it is kind of an interesting kind of like almost timeline film thing happening.
Right. Even though everybody in this movie is using flip phones still.
Yeah. Yeah. And the musical choices. That's another thing, though, I will say, is even though he was using these terrible kind of music choices, or dated music choices, some people wouldn't say terrible, I guess.
Yeah.
But,
it's all of a piece.
That's what I'm saying, is the music actually works with what's going on screen. Like, mm-hmm. there's like a rhythm to it.
Right.
It's not just a popular song laid over whatever's happening. Does that make sense? Like, there is sign of a flow to it. So, again, I can see how Justin Lin became a thing. That's what I got out of this.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, I don't know if I understand how this series got so popular. How it got a second wind. I don't get it.
Bros. Anyways, dudes and bros.
Driving cars and stuff, yeah.
I mean, there's things about the series I like. I mean, I can't say that I'm, like, in love with it. Or that I, like, 100% get it. Like, it's not really my thing.
Sure.
But I get the appeal. I get why, specifically the Justin Lin era, and I guess James Wan did one of those, right?
He did the 7 one.
He did the 7th one, yeah.
Where the Paul Walker died and the whole hubbalooa, and he had to basically remake the film, and yeah.
Right, yeah. I think I get why those films in particular have a following, and I think that Justin Lin understands action really well, and I think that some movies don't necessarily have to depend on characters and have to depend on story, which I know sounds like sacrilege coming from me, but I think there are some action films where it's just about the art of the set piece, and it's just about the art of camera technique and being able to draw adrenaline from practical effects and those kind of things. And there was an era of action filmmaking like that at a point in time. And unfortunately, like now, action filmmaking is kind of taking a turn for, you know, it is all about spectacle, but there's no stakes in any of it because it's almost so effects driven or it's so the setting is so fantasy driven or it's so brand driven usually that you can have a hard time really connecting to it on a visceral level. Where that's the one thing I think Justin Lin's still really good at doing is he can create these spectacle action films that really don't have to exist for any other reason than to witness a spectacle. But he still gives you kind of a visceral connection to the action.
I can agree with that. And again, like you said, I do realize that these are like the bastard child of the action genre. Mm-hmm. And that's why it kind of plays towards a crowd that's kind of still has an affinity for that.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I mean, I get it, but I don't get it, if that makes sense. So this film is perfectly acceptable. If you've already watched it and like it, you know why.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. And if you haven't, you're probably not missing out. Like either you're invested in this thing or you're not. That's all I can really give you. There's cars that go fast. If you enjoy that, you will enjoy this film. There you go.
A lot of drifting going on.
Drifting. If you're a huge fan of drifting, this is the film for you.
Okay. What do you have for us next week? Or the next time we record? We might be a while before we record again.
Yeah. I was thinking about doing the film High Rise. It came out earlier this year. It's got that that devilishly charming and good-looking Tom Hiddleston in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of a thriller horror thing that's happening. I'm not really sure. The previews look kind of neat.
So. Yeah, it's based on a popular novel. Ben Wheatley directed it. He's a guy of acclaim.
I've heard that name.
Mm-hmm. Horror director from England.
What did he do?
He did Sightseers. He did, A Field in England. A few others. He has like four or five pretty big indie horror films under his belt.
Hmm. Okay. I know I've heard the name, so.
Yeah, yeah.
I've probably seen one of them films that he did. None of the ones you name, but anyway.
If anybody has any other opinions about, Fast and the Furious, Tokyo Drift, Don't Breathe, or Kubo and the Two Strings, as well as anything we talked about in this episode, you can email us at jabberinthedrone.com. Follow us at facebook.com/jabberpodcast, and you can see when we post new episodes as well as news stories. You can also see what we're doing on Twitter, where I also post our episodes, and I try and stay in contact with all of our pod friends and Podern families. You can also find us on iTunes and Stitcher, as well as Player.fm and Pocket Cast, Zune, and the Windows Podcast Network. You can find our regular archives at jabberinthedrone.podbean.com, where there's a search bar. And if you click in the search bar and type the name of the movie, you can see if we've reviewed it. You can also read my reviews that I do for the Idaho State Journal at my blog, saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can read some reviews and articles that I've written for the Seattle-based entertainment site mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. And be sure to read or check out Brad's entertainment zine thingy he does online at panelandframe.com. Dampercast is kind of no more, but the archives are still there, so listen to those. And be sure to check out Rob and Denise's Southern California Music Request podcast, The Listening Party, as well as Patrick's Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational from Detroit, which we talked about in this episode. And that's all we got for you this week.
Yep, that's it.
Bye.